This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. In the 1860s, George Pullman started a train company that had sleeping cars and promised traveling around the country in luxury. The passengers were assured of special treatment by the Pullman porters. The Pullman Company intentionally hired black men as the porters. It was an exhausting job that was sometimes demeaning, but it was also one of the best jobs available to African-American men. In fact, the Pullman porters helped create and enlarge the black middle class. The Pullman Company terminated its sleeping car service in the late 1960s. Journalist Larry Tye has written a new book called Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. You write that by the 1960s, Pullman porters had come to personify the grinning servant, the Uncle Tom, but the Pullman porters had been real agents of social change in their prime. In what ways did they help create social change?
In a couple ways. They first started in the 1930s. They launched the first successful black trade union in America. And this was a union that did all the conventional things that a union does in terms of giving them substantially more wages, shorter working hours, general better working conditions. But much more important than that, it gave them a sense of self-respect and a sense of identity that they weren't just these nameless, faceless guys who worked on the cars. They actually gave them name badges, which were very important things for these men who had either been called George or been called by conventional profanities over their years on the Pullman cars. And they were called George because in the tradition of a slave being named after a slave master, they were seen as the servants of George Pullman, the man who launched the company they worked for.
George Pullman started hiring Pullman porters shortly after the end of slavery, and he intentionally wanted to hire dark-skinned ex-slaves. What was his reasoning?
His reasoning was twofold. One, it was that they would come and work for him for whatever price, however low the price he decided to pay them, and he paid them next to nothing, and that they would work as long and as hard as he would demand of them, and he demanded them working 100 or more hours a week. But the more interesting reason that he hired them was he was trying to sell railroad customers back then on a whole new concept, on the concept of overnight travel. And his sleeping cars were more than double the price of a conventional railroad ticket. So he had to convince these passengers that they were going to get such ultimate service, such luxurious service, that it was worth paying this what seemed like an extremely high fee. And who better to convince them that they were going to be waited on brilliantly than ex-slaves who embodied for these white passengers the whole notion of service.
What was the service that they were asked to provide?
They were asked to do everything from serve as a chambermaid to a valet, shining shoes, nursing hangovers, taking care of passengers who were drunk or who had lost their temper. They were basically asked to do everything that somebody would do in a hotel on the entire service staff. And they were the only service staff on this railroad trip across country that could often take 3 or 4 days. So they did every job that was asked them.
Now, you mentioned that there was another reason why George Pullman wanted to hire dark-skinned African-Americans, and that was to clearly differentiate between the porters and the passengers, because these were sleeper cars. People were going to be undressing, preparing for bed. What was his reasoning there?
There was a sense of the social separation, that these should be men who were so clearly from a different world than his white passengers that nobody could ever see themselves as running into these guys in another situation off the train. And the blackness of their skin was seen as one more way to differentiate them from their white passengers and to say, these are people who are different, they are almost invisible to you, and you should not worry that you would ever be embarrassed if you're in a compromising position with them on the train in terms of ever having to see them again in your other life.
There was a whole rule book that he published regulating the porters' interactions with their passengers. What were some of the things in the rule book?
There were some extraordinary things in the rule book. Some of the things that I found most interesting and were most offensive to the Pullman porters were that they should use different colored blankets than either the passengers or the white conductors to make sure that no white employee of George Pullman or no white who rode on his train should ever have to worry about using the same pillow or blanket that a black porter had used. There were rules governing everything from how to fold a sheet to how to swat a fly, that everything. George Pullman believed in a system of management that didn't leave any detail to the discretion of his employees generally, and particularly to his black Pullman porters. So he specified how they should dust the passenger's jacket when they were leaving the train, on exactly what they should do in shining shoes. Every little detail was written down in his hundreds of rules, in his thick rule book that every porter was required to carry every moment that they were on the train.
Do you think that African Americans in the late 1800s and early 1900s considered this a good job?
It was actually considered one of the two best jobs you could have in the black community back then, particularly for a black man. They used to say there was a wonderful expression, Pullman and postal were the best things that a black man in that era could do, and it meant that working for the post office was one of the best jobs in terms of having higher pay and having a job with more status, and the only thing that beat that in terms of blue-collar work in the black world back then was being a Pullman porter.
What was the life like, the day-to-day life of a Pullman porter?
The day-to-day life was one of having to largely wear a mask that essentially allowed them to accept some of the humiliation, some of the abuse that they took from their passengers, and not give it back to them. They lived, in a sense, in two different worlds. One was a world that they showed and the face that they showed to their white passengers, and that was a perpetually obliging one. And the other was a world that they live in with fellow Pullman porters, where they actually develop their own language and their own way of learning how to absorb this abuse without giving it back, that gave them very much of a schizophrenic world back then.
Where did they sleep?
They slept in the smoking room, which doubled as the men's toilet, that they had a little curtain that separated them from the toilets and the wash basins, and they had an old couch back there, and they were given at most 4 hours to sleep at night. Now, in fact, that sleep was interrupted any time a white passenger, a white man, came in to use the toilet or to have a poker game into the late night in the smoking room or just to have a smoke. And so it was 4 hours maximum sleep, perpetual interruptions, and a very uncomfortable old couch separated by a thin curtain that was where they were supposed to get enough sleep to function for their 100 hours of work a month.
Must have been hard to function and hard to be cheerful with so little sleep.
A little hard to be both of those, absolutely. And yet these guys managed to do it for careers that spanned 30 and 40 years, which was a function of two things, of how few other choices they had, and of how the upside of the job, the idea of being able to travel the country, being able to absorb lessons from their wealthy and interesting white passengers, that all of that looked so good compared to what other choices they had in those days, that they were willing to absorb the downsides of the job for all those years.
What impact do you think it had on the porters and on the families of the porters for them to be exposed to the travel and to so many different people?
We can see directly, that's the big piece of this book in terms of trying to understand how they absorbed those lessons and what role it played in their lives. They came to see the value of education. Their white passengers perpetually talked to them about the importance of getting advanced degrees or going to college at all, and they learned those lessons and saw that the kids could get schooling. They learned how to invest the money that they made, and it started out as very little money, but after they had a union, they had enough to actually think about what they would invest it in, and they saw America's leading financiers riding the train with them, and these are people they spent 3 and 4 days with, and they learned really concrete lessons. One porter after another would tell me the great investments they made, which in many cases let them get off the railroads or at a minimum let them put their kids through school. They absorbed the whole lesson of how the white world worked in ways that they went on to put into use in their own life and that let them become, if not themselves, through their children and grandchildren, the founding members of the black middle class.
My guest is Larry Tye, author of the new book Rising from the Rails. We'll talk more about the Pullman porters after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Larry Tye. His new book is called Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters and the Making of the Black Middle Class. How did the Pullman porters start to unionize?
They tried to unionize originally in the late 1800s, and every attempt to unionize was quashed. George Pullman had a monopoly on sleeping car service. He despised the notion of unions, whether they were white unions or black unions, and he managed to fire workers or do anything he had to do to intimidate them. But there was a slow process that began in the mid-1920s where a guy named A. Philip Randolph, who was not a Pullman porter, came in and began a process of unionizing them. And it took a full 12 years from the day they started the process to the day they actually got a union to make this effort work. And Randolph and all of his lieutenants went through dire poverty, experienced brutality at the hands of the Pullman Company, and they were never discouraged enough that they one way or another managed to keep fighting the battle, whether it was in the courts, whether it was through regulatory agencies, and most importantly, trying to keep the Pullman porters on board with him. And he miraculously succeeded in doing it through this long 12-year effort.
What are some of the specific things that the Pullman Company tried to do to discourage the African-American workers from unionizing?
They hired thugs, and this came out in a court case, to beat up one of Randolph's top lieutenants. They fired dozens, and some people say hundreds, of Pullman porters who were involved with the union effort. They went to court and did everything they could to quash every effort there. They tried to lobby Congress and successfully did that to pass laws that made it very difficult to unionize the porters. And they did all these things over a consistent period of 12 years, led at one point by Abe Lincoln's son, who took over for George Pullman as the head of the Pullman Company, Robert Todd Lincoln. And he was one of the best union busters of anybody the Pullman Company had ever had on board.
Once the Pullman porters did unionize, what impact did that have on the labor movement?
It had two impacts in the labor movement. One is it helped to desegregate the labor movement. In the early days, Randolph, A. Philip Randolph, and his porters union were the only black union who was affiliated. They were not a formal part of the AFL, but they were an affiliated union. And Randolph kept pushing for full status, equal status within the AFL hierarchy. He would go to every executive committee meeting and push for all the black unionists to get more equal treatment. And he was a perpetual thorn in the side of everybody who ran the AFL-CIO for about 25 years until he started seeing his efforts yield some results. It had a profound psychological effect on blacks who were trying to unionize to see as visible a workers as the Pullman porters were successfully create their own union. And then he yielded practical results by pushing the union movement to accept blacks on an equal basis.
You know, it's still registering on me that President Lincoln's son became the head of the Pullman Company and was so anti-union. Is it going too far to say that Lincoln signed the proclamation to free the slaves and then his son made sure that some of those ex-slaves or descendants of slaves didn't make a lot of money?
Actually, the Pullman porters over the years had their own expression. Lincoln freed the slaves and his son re-enslaved them. And they didn't feel it was going too far to say that. And that's precisely what Robert Todd Lincoln did. He was as vehement as George Pullman had ever been in terms of trying to limit salaries, limit any potential for promotion, basically limit the opportunities for his Pullman porters and keep them as chattel slaves. And I think that Pullman porters over the years found that a really grim but ironic situation they were perpetually pointing to.
Do you think that the Pullman porters or their union had much of an influence on the civil rights movement?
I think they had a profound influence. If I can tell you a quick story about when we think of the beginning of the civil rights movement, we often date it from the Montgomery bus boycott. And the Montgomery bus boycott began when Rosa Parks was asked to step to the back of the bus, refused to do it, and was arrested. The first person that she summoned to the jail to bail her out of jail was a Pullman porter named Edgar D. Nixon. She knew Nixon because she worked for him. He had an office that he held two hats in that office, and one was as head of the local chapter of the NAACP. The other was as head of the local chapter of the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters. And Nixon had been waiting for years to have just the right test case to try this boycott of the Montgomery bus system. He had one problem, though, in trying to organize this boycott, and that was that he was a Pullman porter who was out on the road so much that he couldn't be there to be at all the meetings. So he looked around town for who would be somebody that could be the perfect front man for him in this boycott, and he saw this young minister who had just graduated from Boston University named Martin Luther King, who happened to have the biggest church in town. And he called King and asked him, would you be willing to come to a meeting I'm organizing of ministers to talk about what we do in organizing a boycott? And King said, give me some time to think about it. Call me back. So Nixon calls 13 other prominent ministers in Montgomery and convinces them to come to a meeting the next day. He calls back King and says, what about it, Reverend King? And King says, okay, I'll come. And Nixon says to him, that's great because I've organized a meeting for tomorrow at your church. And he saw King as perfect. He represented a wealthy church, a large church, and he was young and impressionable enough that Nixon could pull the strings in making this boycott happen with Martin King as the front man to start with. And I think that's an interesting story to me because it's a metaphor for what Porters did throughout the years in the civil rights movement, that they used their union halls, turned over their union halls for civil rights meetings. They bankrolled the civil rights movement at a time when there was no money to support civil rights activities. And their people behind the scenes were critical actors from the earliest days of the civil rights movement.
As part of your research for this book, you found as many surviving Pullman porters, former Pullman porters, that you could, and tried to interview them. You also interviewed family members of former Pullman porters. How did you find these people?
I had been a journalist for 20 years, and the most difficult job I think I've ever done in those 20 years was finding these Pullman porters. I called on every trick and every convention that I'd learned during those years as being a journalist, from putting ads in railroad retirement magazines, putting ads in every black newspaper in every railroad city in America. I had Amtrak helping me track them down. I found their old employment data that was left behind by the Pullman Company and tried to track them down. That way, I wrote letters to probably 500 Pullman workers from those old Pullman Company records. I talked to black ministers in major cities across the country. I talked to civil rights leaders. And those things yielded precious few porters. The technique that actually worked the best, and it shouldn't be surprising, but it surprised me, and I was late to come to it, was talking to people who ran nursing homes in major cities across the country. And they tended to know the Pullman porters were out of the normal network of social interaction. They were so old and so tuned out from the normal networks. They were in their late 80s, in their 90s. One was 102. And the people who knew who they were and where they were people who were running the nursing homes that they were living in. And in every city, once you found one Pullman porter, they would generally be able to lead you to others. But finding that first one was a wonderful challenge, and I ended up coming up with dozens of them, but it was really difficult and a real challenge.
Now, Pullman porters have figured into a lot of movies, even songs. Do you have any favorites of all the ones you poured through?
I found fascinating the way the porters were always background characters in the movies. It wasn't a movie from the Thin Man movies to an entire era of movies from the 1920s to about the 1950s where there was a train that you didn't see this obliging, smiling Pullman porter character who generally had no speaking part in the movie. And they were the perfect backdrop, partly because they conjured up this whole era of elegance. And when they said things, it was generally roles as the compliant, obliging fool. But I think that there were a bunch of authors who managed to go a little deeper, and one of them, my favorite, was Studs Terkel. And he had interviewed E.D. Nixon, this guy who brought Martin Luther King into the civil rights movement, in an oral history that Terkel was doing of the Great Depression. And he quotes Nixon as saying, a Pullman porter can always get into a conversation anywhere. He walked into a barber shop, somebody would say, I didn't see you around here. Or maybe they'd notice his pants with a stripe. Everybody listened because they knowed the Pullman porter been everywhere and they never been anywhere themselves. And I think that's precisely what happened in sketching out the Pullman porter's role. He was a guy to be revered in the black community. And I did an interview at one point with Julian Bond, the chairman of the NAACP. And Bond said, to start out the hour-long interview, he said, I've got really nothing to tell you. I didn't know much about the Pullman porters. And he proceeded to describe how, as a little kid growing up in rural Georgia, he had seen these elegant-looking black men dressed in their fine blue uniforms and had seen them walking down the street as men of grace and men of achievement. And he had no idea what the uniform was about. He didn't really know what their job was. But these were men in the black community who stood out and who were seen as the most prominent and respected men in that world. They had been everywhere. They had seen things nobody else had. And they shared their experiences when they came back from every train trip.
Well, Larry Tighe, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
Larry Tighe's new book is called Rising from the Rails, Pullman Porters, and the Making of the Black Middle Class.